I'd like to welcome you to session number 262. This is a paper entitled Emma Smith is Shaman, and it's going to be presented by Elizabeth Quick, who has a master's degree student in women's spirituality at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology in Palo Alto, California. She also runs several websites. So when you become fascinated with her, you can start going to her websites. Her main one is at bethanymagdalene.blogspot.com. So we're going to hear a presentation from Elizabeth first, and then we're going to be pleased to have respondent Margaret Toscano, whom we probably all know, but for those of you who haven't had the pleasure of meeting Margaret, she is a PhD, and she's an assistant professor in classics at the University of Utah, and she's also the author of a marvelous article that was presented here last year called Are Boys More Important Than Girls? We'll think about that for a little while. And many other articles on women's issues in Mormonism, as well as many very important books. So we're going to listen to Elizabeth Quick, then Margaret will respond, and I'll go get Elizabeth some water.
In recent decades, can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. In recent decades, there has been an extensive conceptual and analytical debate about the definition and nature of shamanism. Despite the fact that there is no agreement among scholars as to the main features of shamanism among different peoples of the world, anthropologists have come to use the term shaman to describe magico-religious practitioners worldwide. In its strictest sense, the word is a religious phenomenon of Siberia and Central Asia, the word coming to us from the Evenki, a Tungusic language spoken in Siberia and northern China and means the one who knows. A shaman is someone who walks between worlds with one foot in each. Religious historian Mircea Eliade calls shamanism, in its most basic definition, a technique of ecstasy, or in other words, an altered state of consciousness. Despite cultural differences, essentially a shaman is a spiritual person with the ability to enter deep states of awareness, which enables the practitioner to act as an intermediary between the mundane world and other dimensions of consciousness in order to access healing power. Anthropologist Barbara Tedlock says, "It is best to think of shamanic activities and perspectives rather than about shamanism as an ideology or institution." Some of the shamanic characteristics and practices may include one or more of the following: exorcism, mediumship, seership and prophecy, divination, psychotherapy, poetry and music, healing, communion with ancestors or deities, psychic abilities such as extrasensory perception and psychokinesis, out-of-body experiences, ascent to the heavens, descent to the underworld, mastery of fire, and influencing the weather. Control over breathing and other bodily functions, and seemingly magical powers, such as invisibility and levitation. Shamans may be called by inspiration, while others are hereditary. According to Tedlock, shamanism consists of both a healing practice and a religious sensibility. A shaman may conduct or participate in rituals, ceremonies, or prayers by dancing, drumming, chanting, singing, or storytelling, but the shaman may or may not hold a clerical role as priest or priestess, although the further back in time you go, the more the two overlap. One scholar notes that most cultures have elements corresponding to both the shamanic and the clerical. Each of these modes predominates in association with certain forms of social organization. Where a society is decentralized, the shamanic mode typically prevails. Where the dominant social form is a centralized bureaucratic state with power concentrated in the hands of trained elites tending to reside in population centers, the clerical mode tends to prevail. Shamanism is often equated with mental illness by some scholars, but not all scholars hold negative views. It is important to note that new investigations and reevaluation of earlier data indicate that most shamans emerge from among the healthiest members of the community. Shamanistic beliefs and practices are found on every continent on the globe, including ancient and contemporary Judeo-Christian cultures and traditions. Shamanism is the oldest spiritual tradition in the world, going back to Paleolithic times, and scientific evidence suggests that it was invented by women. Contrary to popular belief, the word shaman is unrelated to the English word man. Interestingly, UC Berkeley archaeologist Janine Davis Kimball states, "The Russian ethnographers, who were among the first to study the Siberian peoples, maintained that the first shamans were women. In fact, the earliest known skeletal remains of a shaman belong to a woman. She lived over 20,000 years ago in what is now the Czech Republic and was the first ceramic artist of record." British scholar Jeffrey Ash writes that originally shamans were women, the most ancient form of the word itself meaning female shaman. He says that ancient shamanism was not an individual phenomenon, but something that was practiced by the female group. Many traditional cultures maintain that shamanism originated within early women's culture, and there are scholars who agree that menstruation gives women special abilities as shamans. If this is true, then why have female shamans come to be ignored, denigrated, or even erased from the historical record over time? One reason is that common assumptions about the roles of women, combined with the linguistics of translation, have obscured the history of female shamans. Often, ethnographers have rendered the word for shaman differently, depending on the gender of the person described. So rather than listing a woman as a shaman, she might be labeled as an herbalist or a midwife instead. Barbara Tedlock illustrates how the latest scientific technology is beginning to set the record straight. She says, "These discoveries of female skeletons buried together with shamanic artifacts continue to surprise many Western scholars as well as the general public, because it has been assumed for so long that shamanism was primarily a masculine vocation. This misconception has been sustained in part by the practice of assigning sex to bones by the shape of the pelvis, the size of the skull, and the weight and dimensions of limb bones. The problem with this method is that there is great variation in size and weight within the population of each sex. Ambiguous bones, including those of strong or robust females, were often designated as male. At some sites, as many as 80% of all skeletal remains were considered by Western archaeologists to be male, which is an improbable finding that hints at the bias. If we add to this distortion the old assumption that a shamanic burial would be a masculine one, we can see that a woman shaman with a robust body had little chance of being correctly identified. In the past, most of the scientists sexing skeletal materials were male, and as a result, evolutionary theories about the origins of human culture had a tendency to emphasize males. But thanks to the emergence of new technologies such as chemical analysis of the mitochondrial DNA that comes through the female line, and an increase in the number of women scientists, especially paleoanthropologists, progress in the proper sexing of bones has begun to occur. Today, many of our new fossil heroes are turning out to be female. Western researchers and writers who popularized, Western researchers and writers who popularized shaman in the 20th century or shamanism often arbitrarily divided shamanic abilities by gender, popularizing the masculine traditions and sometimes denigrating the feminine ones, like when psychoanalyst / anthropologist Geza Roheim labeled two Hungarian female shaman witches who were, quote unquote, just pretending to be healers. Influenced by Roheim, religious historian Mircea Eliade limited shamanism to soul flight, which he regarded as not only transcendent but also phallic, and he separated it from possession, which he considered imminent and assigned to women, whom he felt were really not shamans. In her book, The Woman in the Shaman's Body, Reclaiming the Feminine in Religion and Medicine, initiated shaman and anthropologist Barbara Tedlock points out the serious limitations to Eliade's work, which she says was published in France in 1951 at the feminine negating height of the psychoanalytic movement of the 1950s, and that his standard reference, shamanism, archaic techniques of ecstasy, wasn't even critiqued for 40 years. But the popular stereotype of Eliade's masculine path of dismemberment, evisceration, and symbolic death leading to rebirth as necessary to shamanic initiation has endured for over half a century. This dichotomy, however, is false. There are cultures where out-of-body soul flight is considered a feminine action, while possession is considered masculine. The actual sex or gender of the person practicing feminine shamanic paths is not a prerequisite. Women and men practicing so-called feminine paths are said to be born into, quote-unquote, the calling. Byamba Dorje Dondog is a highly respected man practicing in the female line of traditional Mongolian shamanism, which includes a midwifery practice. He says, "If it wasn't for my midwifery, I wouldn't have the power to do what I do," acknowledging the feminine roots of shamanism. There are also females that practice traditionally male forms of shamanism, but Tedlock emphasizes that shamanism honors as important both masculine and feminine energies and traditions. She explains, "The most powerful shamans of either sex work with both masculine and feminine forms of energy. So while women shamans are usually nurturing, they also can be brave and powerful when they help with a difficult birth, for instance, or take on the warrior's role in healing. Shamans are taught not to negate or destroy either their masculine or their feminine side. Instead, by shifting genders and embodying characteristics of each gender, they manipulate the male-female polarity itself. Shamans are able to hold incompatible things together because each of the apparent opposites is necessary and in some sense true. As a general rule, women shamans and men trained within a feminine tradition have an interpersonal orientation. They coax their clients to become active participants in their own healing. Male shamans and women trained in a masculine tradition take on a heroic role. They encourage their clients to take the role of passive spectators at their dramatic performances. It is vital that we understand both paths, crucial that we focus on the entire life, death, rebirth continuum," unquote. So now that we have completed a crash course in Shamanism 101 for the 21st century, I'd like to look at some intriguing parallels between the Mormon traditions and shamanic cultures worldwide, and then explore some compelling parallels and connections between the Mormon traditions and the shamanic traditions of the Himalayas, particularly the Tibetan. And then finally, we will look more closely at Emma as a shaman. The first parallel that I would like to note is Tedlock's description of one of the fundamental features of the shamanic worldview, which is the conviction that all entities, animate or otherwise, are imbued with a holistic life force, vital energy, consciousness, soul, spirit, or some other ethereal or immaterial substance that transcends the laws of classical physics. Each member of this wondrous cosmos is a participant in the life energy that holds the world together. The Polynesian Mana, Lakota, Wakanda, and Chinese Taoist Qi are conceived of as powerful forces that permeate everything. In short, this is what academics usually label as animism, something that always brings to my mind the following LDS scriptures and ideas, such as Doctrine and Covenant, Section 88, where it says that the light of Christ is in all things, gives life to all things, and through all things, and is the law by which all things are governed. It also brings to mind Joseph Smith's comment, "There is no such thing as immaterial matter. All spirit is matter, but it is more fine or pure, and can only be discerned by purer eyes. We cannot see it, but when our bodies are purified, we shall see that it is all matter," unquote. The last quote dovetails nicely with Tedlock, or Joseph's last quote, dovetails nicely with Tedlock, who says, "For a shaman, energy is an expression of spirit transforming into matter." Tedlock describes the heart of shamanic practice as the active pursuit of knowledge, which she says takes many forms, among those the understanding of animal and human behavior, the identification of medicinal plants and their uses, the hands-on healing knowledge of bone setting, massage, and midwifery, and the empathic knowledge of the human psyche. Through calendrical study, divination, and prophecy, shamans seek knowledge of the future, and through recitation of myths, epics, charms, spells, songs, and the genealogies of previous shamans, they pass along knowledge of the past and of the spirit world. And since shamans everywhere wish to know more than they have experienced in their everyday waking lives, they may extend their wisdom through dream journeys or psychedelic trips that provide, in the words of one shaman, 1,000 years of human living rolled into one day. The latter sound rather like the shaman Joseph Smith when he said, "Could you gaze into heaven 5 minutes, you would know more than you would by reading all that ever was written on the subject." And last year, Dr. Robert Beckstead made an extremely compelling case for the early Mormon use of entheogens. The word entheogen being a neologism from the ancient Greek entheos, meaning God within, and describes the religious and cultural use of psychoactive plants in a sacramental manner. According to Tedlock, divination can take many forms, including the casting of lots, which is mentioned throughout the Bible, dream interpretation, the use of consciousness-enhancing plants, and crystal gazing. The latter, which brings to mind the early Mormon use of seer stones, brilliantly chronicled in D. Michael Quinn's Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview. I think that the Mormon quest for gnosis is epitomized by two things. First, the idea in the 19th century Mormon parlance that everything is composed of some degree of intelligence, quote-unquote, or what we might now call consciousness, which is said to be, quote-unquote, eternally progressing, or in contemporary terms, evolving. Secondly, the principle of personal revelation and the Mormon sensibility of seeking and receiving truth, let it come from whence it may, quote-unquote. Another astonishing parallel that I came across with the LDS culture and another shamanic culture is the concept of adoption and sealing family lineages together. In Barbara Tedlock's book, she reports that upon shamanic initiation, both herself and her shamanic partner and husband, Dennis Tedlock, and all of their family members, both living and dead, were adopted into the patrilineage of one of their teachers, Don Andre, a Mayan shaman from Guatemala. Finally, a parallel in cosmology with certain shamanic cultures that piqued my interest is the belief among some Asian cultures in a celestial goddess. Quoting Tedlock again, "Studies of shamanism that focus on the sky have ignored the existence of celestial goddesses and the practices associated with them. Mircea Eliade, in discussing the shamanic symbolism of ascent to the sky, asserted that the supreme gods of archaic peoples are called He on High, He of the Sky, or simply Sky. The truth is that North Asian celestial cults focused on bringing babies into the world and nurturing them. The fact that the celestial goddesses were oriented around fertility was abhorrent to Buddhist missionaries who set out in the 12th century to destroy the feminine cults. Their efforts at suppression were only partly successful, although the celestial goddesses were expunged from many written historical records." This certainly brings to mind the LDS concept of Heavenly Mother and her LDS daughters here on Earth, who, as a spiritual practice, emulate their mother in heaven by giving birth to mortal bodies to house the spirit bodies birthed pre-existently by their celestial mother. One of the shamanic cultures or shamanistic cultures that I have found has many remarkable parallels to the Mormon traditions are Himalayan cultures, especially Tibet. Most people are somewhat familiar with the existence of Buddhism as the primary religious tradition in Tibetan culture. It was brought to Tibet from India by request of the king about 1,200 years ago by Guru Rinpoche, also known as Padmasambhava, in the 8th century, but Tibet's more ancient shamanic roots are less well known. Revealingly, further etymology on the word shaman suggests the Tungus term shaman is related to the Chinese term sha-man, meaning Buddhist monk, as well as a Sanskrit word meaning Buddhist ascetic. And interestingly, Eliade noted that there is a resemblance between yogic techniques, such as those represented in Buddhist meditation, and the techniques of shamanism, unquote. This is interesting because British anthropologist and museologist Richard Rudgley asserts that quote, it is impossible, or it is possible that the martial arts that we tend to associate with Taoist and Buddhist traditions have their prototypes in prehistoric shamanistic practices, unquote. Even more interestingly, shamanic scholar, teacher, and practitioner Vicki Noble believes that very ancient women's practices were codified into what we now know as yoga. She says, just as women today in dorms or other communal living situations will synchronize their menstrual cycles and end up getting their periods at the same time, so the kundalini, or shamanistic energy, is also contagious in circles of women. Ancient communities apparently took advantage of this fact and sanctified it, making women's blood cycles the center of their social organization. The origins of yoga lie in this ancient social organization that allowed and encouraged the free, spontaneous flow of kundalini energy through the female group, and by extension, throughout the entire community. Bleeding, birthing, healing, and dying were supported by rituals of trance, dance, and an instinctual form of ecstasy facilitated by the women. In this way, disease was purged from the community through ritual, and fertility in women, animals, and food crops was enhanced and magically supported by the simple enjoyment of the biological ecstasy of life on Earth. Truly, those were the days of living yoga, unquote. Noble, who has spent time in Tibet, as well as archaeological sites along the Silk Road, also situates this yogic tradition in a larger geographical region beyond Asia and going back to at least Neolithic times. She calls it, quote, a coherent lineage of shamanistic practices and ecstatic rituals that cuts across the boundaries and nationalism that take up so much space in our history books. She explains, recent evidence strongly suggests that there is a direct line of connection, perhaps even descent, from the Mediterranean Bronze Age yoginis and those historical yoginis recorded 2,000 years later in India and Tibet. Eurasian mummies unearthed from the burials in the Altai Mountains of Mongolia and the Tian Shan Mountains of China have changed our ideas regarding Bronze Age and Iron Age peoples, showing that they traveled thousands of miles in their migrations and shared cultural contacts that connected them all the way from Turkey and Greece to Tibet, India, and the western edges of China. Buddhist monasteries and temples were financed by merchants engaged in active commerce along the Silk Road that linked China to Rome. Female priestesses wearing high conical black hats like Russian babas and European witches of the Middle Ages have been found in the Tarim Basin from the late 2nd millennium BCE, bringing to life the many enigmatic textual references to Dakini witches and Yogini queens. In the later histories of pre-Buddhist Tibet that have only recently become available in English, unquote. Last year at Sunstone, there was a magazine article and a symposium presentation on the Yoga of Christ. Similar yogic parallels can be found in the life and work of Joseph and Emma Smith. In many cultures, shamanism is transmitted to a couple, and according to Tedlock, erotic energy is an essential component of many shamanic traditions. She says that abstinence is also used in many traditions as a way of manipulating sexual energy. Tedlock explains that sexually ecstatic states are celebrated literally as well as symbolically in tantric and kundalini yoga, both of which evolved out of North Asian shamanic practices. The Sanskrit word tantra comes from the root tan, meaning to stretch or to weave. Tantra is the art of weaving together the spiritual and the material worlds. It is a way of realizing the divine essence through bodily experience, especially the creative force of sexuality. The Sanskrit term kundalini, meaning serpent power, designates divine sexual energy. During orgasm, lovers often appear as if possessed by spirits, shuddering and quivering, groaning and crying out, momentarily blind and deaf to all that surrounds them. Scientists point to a strong neurological connection between sexuality, particularly female sexuality, and going into a trance. Tedlock points out that the blending of sacred eroticism with ecstatic visionary experience is not limited to Asia, and she points to its once important role in Christianity, quoting St. Teresa and the deeply ecstatic language of other Christian mystics. Over the last few years, scholars have begun to note parallels between Joseph Smith and the yogic tradition of Terma and Tirthan, or hidden treasure texts, and the shamanic seers who find them. At a conference at the Library of Congress on the 200th anniversary of the birth of Joseph Smith, historian Grant Underwood discussed historian Richard Bushman's invitation, quote, to situate Joseph in broader transnational histories, beyond the border of the United States, and even beyond a Judeo-Christian heritage, which enables us to discover some interesting parallels. In the Nyingma tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, for instance, a fundamental source of religious teaching is the termas, treasures. Termas include sacred texts composed anciently, primarily by the great guru Rinpoche, Padmasambhava, and hidden by him in various secret locations to be discovered at a later date. Termas can only be discovered by a special class of spiritually enlightened adepts, bodhisattvas, also known as tirthans, treasure finders. Only tirthans can reveal these texts because they are written in the cryptic language of the Dakini, supernatural beings. Placing these histories side by side, Smith looks, and I'm still quoting Grant Underwood here, Smith looks like an American tirthan seer translating ancient texts written in cryptic Reformed Egyptian by the great prophets of the past, Mormon and Moroni. The prophet's purpose for writing, as it had been for Guru Rinpoche, included keeping the faith on track by making clear the fundamental, plain, and precious principles of the tradition. Further, it is interesting to note that some of the Tibetan termas are called mind treasures because they are not physically discovered, but are revealed through the mind of the tirthan. This phraseology recalls the prophecies of Enoch, or the parchment of John, revealed by Joseph Smith. What is interesting here is not to preposterously argue for any organic connection between Joseph Smith and Tibetan Buddhism, but to notice the similar mechanisms for authorizing a religious text and to ponder the social and intellectual dynamics that make them effective, unquote. Exploring the Eastern treasure texts tradition, Noble says, it is believed that students of Padmasambhava reborn in later centuries would remember their earlier incarnations through the vehicle of revealed treasures, which they spontaneously express through unique ways in their lifetime. The Terma treasures are sometimes physical, texts, amulets, relics, but frequently they are treasures of the mind. In a broad understanding of the concept, one might say that the excavation of European mummies in China and Mongolia counts as terma, along with more technical artifacts unearthed in Tibet over the centuries. And that was a quote by Vicki Noble. Tibetan teacher Namkhai Norbu describes the process, quote, as one of direct transmission from teacher to student through the use of symbols, and describes the language of the Dakini as a form in which the ancient secret teachings are encoded until the time a certain predestined people around the world will discover portions of them, which it is their task to translate into the cultural language of their time and place. To be a part of this lineage does not require that the person be participating in a particular spiritual form, such as Buddhism, although the teacher doing the transmitting may well be Buddhist. Is it possible that there could be a universal spiritual lineage that connects the Tibetan and Mormon traditions? John Twatness over at BYU's Maxwell Institute wrote a book titled The Book of Mormon and Other Hidden Books, detailing numerous ancient traditions of angels as writers and guardians of written records, hidden to come forth to later generations. The book demonstrates that various elements of the Book of Mormon story have antecedents in the ancient world that were not known to Joseph Smith and his contemporaries, and that while various parts of the world share similar traditions, it is most prominent in the ancient Near East, the land which the Book of Mormon people immigrated to the New World. And this passage from the Book of Mormon, 2 Nephi, chapter 29, contains a non-sectarian message stating that the divine realm deals with all of the earth's peoples and inspires cultures around the globe. Know ye not that there are more nations than one? I bring forth my word unto all the nations of the earth. Wherefore murmur ye, because that ye shall receive more of my word? That I remember one nation like unto another? Wherefore, because that ye have a Bible, ye need not suppose that it contains all my words, neither need ye suppose that I have not caused more to be written. For I command all, both in the east and in the west and in the north and in the south and in the islands of the sea, that they shall write the words which I speak unto them. I shall also speak unto all nations of the earth, and they shall write it. Vicky Noble and Tibetan Tulku Thondup Rinpoche state, treasure finders, known as Tertons, sometimes female Terma... Let me start this quote over. Treasure finders, known as Tertons, sometimes female Terma finders, are referred to as Chondroma, which basically means Dakini. Receive their termas in the language of the Dakini, which is a secret script that has to be decoded. Terma finders must have a consort with whom to practice their mystical yoga. The support of the consort has two purposes: to produce and maintain the wisdom of the union of the great bliss and emptiness, freedom, by which the adept attains the ultimate state, and the consort causes him or her to awaken the realization as well as to discover the termas. The special consort, who has made the appropriate aspirations in the past, is the key to accomplishment, which is one of the reasons why all Tertons happen to have consorts. Dakini is a Tibetan word meaning sky dancer, sky goer, or sky walking female, and describes a female shamanic practitioner equivalent to an Indian yogini, the embodiment of cosmic feminine energy and wisdom, a practitioner of supernatural yogic powers. Vicky Noble says that, quote, the narratives of the great Tibetan and Indian masters generally contain a segment in which the yogi is awakened or initiated by a yogini or female guru, also disguised as an ordinary woman. The Dakini's identity is ambiguous, and she is often not recognized for who she is, even by advanced yogis. Noble says that Dakinis have to integrate the time and the place that they live in, and that, quote, Tertons and Chondromas express their discoveries through the particular vernacular of their time and for the direct benefit of their special constituency of their students. Barbara Tedlock adds, the shamanic practitioners, quote, ritually enact their local system of myths and symbols and interpret the patient's condition within that system, unquote. Thank you. Was Emma Joseph's tantric consort the energizer and necessary ingredient for the coming forth of the Book of Mormon? A visitor to the home of Emma's youth once described her as fine-looking, smart, a good singer, and she often got the power. Emma's biographers say what the power was the visitor did not elaborate upon, but Emma did have a deep faith and knew the Bible well. When Joseph told her of his vision in the woods, she believed him. Joseph was prepared by supernatural visitations for years before he could go to the Hill Cumorah in upstate New York to retrieve the buried treasure known as the Golden Plates. Reading the earliest accounts of this romantic adventure quest, Emma looks a lot like a classical yogini. Henry Harris had heard about the Golden Plates directly from Joseph Smith and recollected Smith's interaction with an angel and his use of a seer stone. Quote, I had a conversation with him and asked him where he found them and how he came to know where they were. He said he had a revelation from God that told him they were hidden in a certain hill, and he looked in his stone and saw them in the place of deposit. Then an angel appeared and told him that he could not get the plates until he was married, and that when he saw the woman that was to be his wife, he should know her and she would know him. Joseph's close friend, Joseph Knight, reported that when Joseph went that fall to the hill named Cumorah, the personage told him that he could have the record the following September, quote, if he brought with him the right person, unquote, and still quoting Knight here, and indicated that Joseph would know who that was, unquote. Joseph, or Knight said that Joseph, quote, looked into his glass and found it was Emma Hale, daughter of old Mr. Hale of Pennsylvania, unquote. One of the three witnesses to the Book of Mormon, Martin Harris, recollected being told by the Smith family how Joseph obtained the golden plates and added an interesting visual detail to Emma's role that mystical equinox evening. After this, on the 22nd of September, 1827, before a day, Joseph took the horse and wagon of old Mr. Stoll, and taking his wife, he went to the place where the plates were concealed, and while he was obtaining them, she kneeled down and prayed. This particular account shows Emma playing an active spiritual role in the obtaining of the plates. Emma acted as a scribe for Joseph for a short time before Martin Harris became scribe, and also immediately after Harris was rejected by Smith for losing the pages. Like a veritable Dakini, Emma wrote in 1829, "In writing for your father, I frequently wrote day after day, often sitting at the table close by him, he sitting with his face buried in his hat with the stone in it, and dictating hour after hour with nothing between us." In the final section of this paper, I'd like to present five specific shamanic elements in the life and work of Emma Smith. Number one is the laying on of hands. Thanks to much scholarly work in recent years, we know that as a priestess and the head of the Relief Society, Emma administered blessings of health, which is a healing rite customarily administered by the laying on of hands. In Women as Healers in the Modern Church, Bettina Lindsay states, quote, "In Nauvoo, Illinois, the women of the Relief Society frequently pronounced blessings upon each other. Sister Durfee and Abigail Leonard tell of receiving blessings of health from Emma Smith and her counselors." Lindsay notes that the laying on of hands is the oldest form of ritual healing known to virtually every religion. Early rock carvings in Egypt and Chaldea and cave paintings in the Pyrenees that are 15,000 years old portray the laying on of hands. Number two is speaking in tongues. Although Emma's biographers, Newell and Avery, report that there does not seem to be any indication that Emma Smith spoke in tongues, they do mention that the practice became a part of the saints' worship, particularly among women, into the 20th century. Dr. Mihai Hopal indicates speaking in tongues, also known as glossolalia, in his definition of shamanic characteristics, because he says glossolalia can be seen as the audible phonetic expression of the neuron psychological trance process. The next category in the shaman's repertoire where we find Emma is said by Dr. Hopal to often be overlooked, the shaman as poet or singer. Hopal notes that, quote, "oral ecstatic performance and collective singing," unquote, is a feature in some shamanistic societies and is shamanistic musical performance and the ritualized narration of myth by singers of traditional oral narratives, unquote. He quotes R. Mastro Matei, who said that a text recited in an ecstatic context becomes shamanic. The Elect Lady revelation that was given to Emma commissioned her to make a selection of sacred hymns, and another early Mormon revelation equates the Song of Righteousness, quote-unquote, with prayer, which is sometimes linked to meditative or altered states of consciousness. What's more, Newell and Avery speculate that Emma could have been a contributor herself, as several hymns are of unknown authorship. The remaining two categories where I have located Emma come from a book that contained information about her that I have never encountered anywhere else. Buddy Young Green's book, Reflections of Emma, reveals that after Joseph's death, after Brigham Young had taken most of the Mormons west with him, leaving Emma in Nauvoo, Emma Smith became a prolific midwife and herbalist. Midwifery has rarely been acknowledged as a shaman's art, yet spanning multiple cultures and continents, Barbara Tedlock has begun to locate extensive archaeological and ethnographic evidence for midwifery as a branch of shamanism. She points out that in many cultures, midwives may enlist spiritual aid before, during, and after birth. Thus, they are shamanic healers in their own right. She elaborates, women on feminine shamanic paths focus their attention around birth. They receive their shamanic calling during menarche or pregnancy and are symbolically born into the profession. And adds that women shamans are nearly always midwives. The act of helping souls transform themselves in order to cross from the other world into this world turns out to be at the heart of feminine shamanic traditions worldwide. While the masculine traditions focus on a shaman symbolically dying into shamanhood, the feminine traditions focus on the shamans being born into it. Historically, midwives are usually also herbalists, and Emma was no exception. Tedlock says that part of the active shamanic pursuit of knowledge is the identification of medicinal plants and their uses, and that herbalism is shamanic because in the identification, collection, preparation, and use of plants, herbalists go beyond the rational intelligence that is based on everyday experience and teaching. They also rely on inspirational knowledge. For indigenous peoples, it is wisdom rather than knowledge per se that is the goal. Knowledge consists of empirical information passed from teacher to pupil. Wisdom adds to that an intuitive grasp of the complex connections and forms of consciousness in the natural world. Herbalists insist that in order to choose a proper medicine for any situation, a healer must come to know plants as living beings. It is not the plant alone that cures. The healing comes from the greater power that exists within the spirits of the plant, the healer, the patient, and the culture. While there are herbalists in many societies who are not trained as shamans, they do not enter a trance or experience ecstasy. All shamans know the plant realm well, and in most cultures, herbal healing, like midwifery, is a strongly feminine specialty. For more information on the botanical arts of early Mormonism, medical anthropologist John Heinerman has done an excellent job extensively documenting the ethnobotany of early Mormonism in Joseph Smith and Herbal Medicine. In closing, I want to thank Dr. C. Jess Grossbeck for paving the way for this paper with his 2005 Sunstone presentation, Joseph Smith and the Shaman's Vision, A Forgotten Paradigm for the Life of the Mormon Prophet. I would also like to thank Kenneth Shaw for pointing out to me over 10 years ago the remarkable parallels between Joseph Smith and Tibetan chertons. Lastly, I would like to thank Barbara Tedlock, Vicki Noble, and Max Dashew for personally teaching most of what I know about female shamanism.
I would like to begin by thanking Elizabeth for this thought-provoking and very well-researched paper. She challenged me to re-examine my way of thinking about Emma Smith, which is always, from my perspective, a good thing. We're challenged to think of things in a new way. And she also stimulated, I think, some important questions for us as Mormons. So what I would like to do in my short comments is to raise five questions that I'm not going to attempt so much to give answers to, but to try to stimulate interaction with you for the short time we'll have for questions. The first question that I think Elizabeth's paper raises for us is, what is the importance of terminology? Why use the term shaman? As Elizabeth goes through the various definitions of this term and goes through all of the research that has been done, I mean, it includes typical spiritual gifts that we have other terms for, such as visionary or prophet or healer or seer or midwife or ecstatic performer, somebody who does, you know, a dreamer, in a sense, almost a poet prophet. We have all of these other terms. So why use the term shaman? To me, this is a very important question. You know, how do terms shape how we think about things? For me, perhaps the importance of the term shaman is that it gives us one term that combines a lot of the other spiritual practices. So if you remember, as Elizabeth was talking about the term shaman, one of the kind of succinct definitions is a person who is a mediator between the spiritual and the physical. And really, again, a lot of these other terms can send us in that same direction, but I think shaman in particular focuses on this interconnection between the other realm, the spiritual realm, and the physical. And this may, in fact, be its real importance for Mormonism, because I see that Mormonism, if you compare it to certain other religious traditions in the West, if you look at Christianity and other things, they've maybe been more transcendent. I think Mormonism is one of those traditions that does combine the spiritual and the physical in a very real way. And I think it is a very good term in that sense. Now, this brings up the second question that I think is very important in this discussion, and that is that, of course, shaman, as Elizabeth pointed out, is a term that was borrowed from way back into the ancient traditions of Asia, and that really it was revived, as you said, by Eliade, who won a very important comparative religion scholar, and he was the one that really made this a term that we use in the West. Now, whenever we talk about borrowing a term like this, I think that there are both pros and cons about borrowing terms. So just to quickly go over a couple of these. On the one hand, whenever you borrow a term, there's always the problem of erasing the differences between those two traditions. That no matter what kinds of parallels we find between either Mormonism, Buddhism, or Mormonism and Jewish mysticism, or Mormonism and Catholicism, there are always differences as well. And sometimes in the attempt to show the parallels, we can erase those differences, and it can become a kind of cultural appropriation that maybe, I mean, certain scholars think that it can become imperialistic. Now, certainly that can happen. I don't think you were doing that, Elizabeth, but that is a danger. And those distinctions, I think, are very important. On the other hand, I think the positive aspect of showing parallels is that it does allow us to see the ways in which there is continuity in human experience and maybe have more sympathy for traditions other than our own. For me, even more important than this is the idea that when we borrow a term like shaman, it really I think, forces us to think about the terms that we already have in new ways. And for me, that's always a good exercise, where it creates paradigm for a new way about thinking about our spiritual practices, and especially more expansive ways. And of course, I think there's an important element in this as well, that sometimes by showing parallels, it can break down certain prejudices. Now, one particular prejudice that I want to mention that I think is very important in all of this discussion is that in the Western religious tradition since the Enlightenment, there has been a preference for the rational over the intuitive or the sort of irrational or the ecstatic. And I think it's interesting that, as Elizabeth pointed out, that there are some scholars who have even argued whether or not shamans are mentally ill. And, of course, this is always a discussion that comes up with any kind of visionary people. Now, this also leads into my third question, which I think is important as well in terms of talking about Emma Smith. And that is that in the Western tradition, often the sort of ecstatic, out of control emotions have often been connected with women's practices. And so in the West, if you look at visionary practices in the West, there's often been a tendency to prefer those practices that are seen as more transcendent and more, you know, we don't want to have too much bodily excess or anything like this. And so the third question I have is, why has it been so difficult to see women in a shamanic role? You have somebody again like Eliade who wanted to kind of see this as a masculine term. I know we're short on time, but just quickly here, for my doctoral work, for my PhD, my dissertation was on female mystics in Western Europe in late medieval period. And a very interesting thing that happened with the whole mystical tradition in the West is that the more bodily mysticism, which often women were connected with, has always been seen as sort of an inferior brand of mysticism in the West to what they saw as the male version, which is where you get beyond the body and you're always transcending and getting beyond the bodily. And I think part of the importance of this discussion is the trying to reclaim this feminine role as a very positive thing. Now, women can be in a double bind in all of this, and this typically happens with women when it comes to spiritual practices. On the one hand, if you have too much spiritual power, then you're criticized as being a witch. You're too emotional, you're too out of control, all of these things. And so we have a problem with that. On the other hand, if a woman is too rational, then she's sort of dismissed as not having spiritual power. So women can be criticized whichever way they go, and that's a real problem here. The fourth question, of course, is it legitimate to call Emma Smith a shaman? Now, I have mixed feelings on this. On the one hand, I think it's very important that we see that she was much more spiritually gifted than the church has ever given her credit for. And Elizabeth, of course, gave some of the good evidence for this. She definitely, I certainly believe in the tradition that she was ordained as a priestess, along with Joseph Smith, that she was called an elect lady. She was certainly a healer, a compassionate leader, and so forth. Now, in terms of can we actually call her a shaman, I am not completely convinced. I'm intrigued by the whole evidence with her as the tantric consort that Joseph needed for receiving the plates. I think that's a very interesting tradition. The whole question that arises for me there is she simply this consort that he needs because he's the real conduit, or does she have her independent spiritual power? And I'm not sure we have the historical evidence to say either way. So I'm still not sure whether or not I can call Emma Smith shaman, because for me, you do have to be this sort of intermediary between the mundane world and other dimensions of consciousness. However, to me, there's another very important point here, and that is that I think that there have been Mormon women who are shamans. So whether or not historically we can say Emma was a shaman, it depends on her definition, it depends on how much we trust the sources and so forth, but I think that it's vital for us to say women do act as shamans, they are visionaries, they do act as these intermediaries, even if we don't honor them in the official church as prophets and seers. So that leads me to my last question, which maybe for this audience may be the most important. Why is it so difficult for us in the church today to claim and use spiritual gifts? Why must we look to other traditions sometimes more to find these rather than being able to claim them within our own tradition? Now, I'm very much one that believes it's valid to borrow from other traditions. In fact, I see this as a basic premise of Mormon kind of culture. If you go back to Joseph Smith, you quoted part of this, Elizabeth, where he says one of the grand fundamental principles of Mormonism is to embrace truth, let it come from whence it may. I've always taken that as one of my mantra. But on the other hand, I think there's a lot of hesitancy in the church to do this. And I know that there's a lot of talk on websites and discussion groups about women looking at various alternative practices. I think that there is extreme hunger in the church for expressing spirituality. I think that our church meetings have become both intellectually and spiritually arid, and I think that we have this longing to express something else. My question is, how can we do this in a way that, I don't know. Can we do this and still be Mormon, I guess? And is there a legitimately Mormon way? I wish there were. I don't know. So I don't know how much time we have. Oh my goodness, we're really short, but those are my questions.
Well, this has been fascinating. We have about 4 minutes left, so probably time for two questions. Go ahead and mob the mic.
Comment/question. My wife is a practitioner of energy medicine, body talk specifically, and she's also, I'm the most kooky in the family. She would never consider coming to Sunstone, so she's a very normal mainstream Mormon, and I think she would also fit into this category, so to answer your last question, I think that's perhaps how that starts to work. And curious about what you think of energy medicine in the shaman tradition.
I think it's used. I mean, I do think
Yeah, I do think it is one of the characteristics or practices within this very broad general definition of shamanism. And yeah, I actually do know quite a few LDS women who do energy work, and Dojatri back there is including a study of that in her PhD dissertation right now, so you might want to have your wife talk to Do. get interviewed. Yeah, plug for Do's dissertation.
Come on, guys. It's starting to feel like testimony meeting. All right. Well, that was great fun. Okay, good. There we go.
I wanted someone else to have the time to do this because I'm always doing this. But your question about why this is not acceptable, this language of shamanism, it's not acceptable in the church. Brigham Young is the one who just absolutely squashed this kind of thing among women when he discouraged women from getting together even. They still had the midwives who practiced shamanism, but they were also women in the early days of the church were meeting together, and they were speaking in tongues, and they were having meetings that were like that. It was the women. But he really, really discouraged it, and so did Eliza R. Snow, even though she spoke in tongues herself, but she didn't want a lot of other women practicing what she did. But I think that happened. That's when it happened, when the saints came into the valley, and Brigham Young is the one who did it. And he didn't allow Relief Society for 13 years after they got into the valley. So then a new group of women of a different age and background and beliefs were the women in Relief Society, and the others died. And I think that's what happened.
Extremely briefly, second part of the answer to your question about energy work, I just thought of something really important, which was that in the past, I was trained in other cultures' traditions of energy work, like Asian and Hawaiian. Like, I received attunements to do energy work on people. And after a while, I realized, you know, I already received an attunement to do energy work in my own tradition. And that's when I was 8 years old and I was confirmed and I received the gift of the Holy Ghost in the LDS Church. And so now that is the only form of energy work that I do. I don't no longer use those traditions from the other cultures. I use the Holy Spirit in my healing work. So I just wanted to point that out. Thank you.
Great fun. Give our presenters a hand. Have fun.